Listen to this recent headline from the May 14th, 2011 Wall Street Journal. The headline reads, Sun Setting on British Power. The subtitle, From Ruling the Waves to Waving Goodbye. The article's by Alastair MacDonald. I would like to read a few excerpts from the article. That title, of course, should ring true for us. Sun Setting on British Power. From Nelson, atop his column, to Wellington, gracing his arch, speaking of war memorials in the city of London, this city is filled with monuments to the martial glories of an island whose forces once dominated continents and ruled the waves. Today, though, the modest British intervention in Libya is fueling fresh anxiety here and in Washington about the nation's shrinking military muscle as the United Kingdom cuts defense spending in response to a record deficit. The United Kingdom is in the midst of the most aggressive fiscal tightening since World War II, a process that U.S. defense officials are watching with great concern. You know, I wonder even how many of us, as old as some of us are, even recall the might and power and dominance of the British Commonwealth, the nation of Britain, the United Kingdom, and all of its colonies and all of its landholdings around the globe, the huge dominance they enjoyed in naval power, when they indeed did control the waves. And I think perhaps that especially our younger generations, perhaps even some of us here, 20-somethings or 30-somethings, ruling the waves, big deal. We've been in space for 30 years with the space shuttle. We regularly fly across the ocean. How many of you have flown transatlantic? Several of you have. It's really an easy thing to do. You get on the plane late at night. You land in London. It's morning or whatever. You get up. You're ready to go. It's really nothing. You look down at the water, perhaps, from 30,000 feet. Ooh, I hope we don't have to go down there. But there were once huge wooden ships with sails that plied the seas, and commerce was by ship, and travel was by ship. And the sea lanes were a very valuable commodity to be controlled, and much of the world's commerce was carried on by ship. Much of it is still shipped, but there are so many other means today, and we are so, quote, advanced, unquote, beyond the days of Admiral Nelson, that we hardly think about British dominance of the waves and the incredible size and scope of the British Commonwealth of Nations. We look at that little island now and we think how quaint. They have a lot of museums. They drive a little differently over there. They have some other characteristics about their culture. They have a lot of great museums. But really, beyond that, what's the big deal about Britain? Britain used to be something. Quickly, unfortunately, it's becoming a little less than something, and perhaps approaching nothing as far as military strength and power is concerned. The cutbacks, continuing, come as broad geopolitical forces are reshaping the global military landscape. The U.S., which is also trying to curtail military spending, remains the world's dominant military power. China is engaging in a military buildup that has alarmed many of its Asian neighbors. Do you know what happens next month? Joint military exercises between who? The United States and, we were at war with them many years ago, Vietnam. That should have a little ring of irony to it. But here we are in the 21st century. China engaging in a huge military buildup. If you were China's neighbor, you'd be nervous too. If you were Japan, you'd be very nervous with the loss of their nuclear reactor, with the loss of so much materiel and people from the tsunami. Think of how much looking over the shoulder the Japanese are doing right now as far as their ultimate survival is concerned. How vulnerable are they right now? And how many nations are ultimately going to look to the United States for military strength and support when push comes to shove? And it will come. But, of course, we have a little bit of a deficit issue ourselves. Have any of you ever gone online and looked at the national deficit clock? It's quite an experience. You should Google it and take a look, because those numbers spin faster than a Model A speedometer. It's really rolling. And it's an incredible thing to see. They have all kinds of different categories. But yes, I'd say we do have a bit of a deficit challenge, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Other NATO members are grappling with budget constraints while keeping a wary eye on Russian improvements in their military as well as changes in the Middle East. Russia would dearly love to be a military player again. And there's no doubt that they are pushing to become more influential on the world scene. The geopolitical landscape is changing dramatically, and for our brother nation, our most faithful ally over the years, Britain, to be diminishing their military support and strength should be quite unsettling to us as a nation. Listen to these descriptions of the glory days of the British Empire, which was arguably the most powerful, dominant, and dynamic empire in the history of the world, all emanating from a small island nation. A small island nation. When you think of the size of Britain and the British Isles, how could so much be done by so few? It's really an incredible story. Many of us can remember this Britain of old, a staunch ally, a victor in two world wars, the most dominant colonial power the world has ever known, now a mere shadow of its former self. Now, is this to be considered a product of national evolution? Nations grow and expand, then nations shrink and disappear. Where is the Roman Empire? Where's the Greco-Macedonian Empire? They're all history. And is this just the natural course of events? Or does this, in fact, have a dramatic impact on the future of all of mankind? Well, we know from prophecy that it does, and that this is far beyond a nation in decline. This means far more than anything that has happened to this point historically. Now, a few quotes from Wikipedia regarding the British Empire. Just to refresh your memory. The British Empire comprised the dominions, colonies, protectorates, mandates, and other territories ruled or administered by the United Kingdom. It originated with the overseas colonies and trading posts established by England in the late 16th and early 17th centuries, due largely to their vast naval power and their ability to travel to these far-flung places and set up posts, be they trading posts or military posts to protect their interests. At its height, the British Empire was the largest empire in history, and for over a century was the foremost global power. That little island. By 1922, the British Empire held sway over about 458 million people. 458 million people. This is 1922. What's our population today? 300 million in the United States? So when you add another 158 million, and that little island nation was responsible for 458 million people, or one quarter of the world's population at the time. How could all of this have happened? In addition, the British Empire covered more than 13,012,000 square miles. Almost one quarter of the total land surface of the earth. Isn't that amazing? One quarter of the world's population, one quarter of the world's total land area. As a result, its political, linguistic, and cultural legacy is widespread. Where do you think America got a lot of its ideas on government? How do you think many of the democracies of the world today got their start? How did Australia get their start? How about New Zealand? How about many of the other colonies that were once under British control and dominion? At the peak of its power, it was often said that the sun never sets on the British Empire, because its span across the globe ensured that the sun was always shining on at least one of its numerous territories. Can you imagine that? The sun never set on the British Empire. How many of you have heard of Pax Britannica? Pax Britannica. It is Latin for the British peace. The British peace. And of course it was modeled after the original Pax Romana. This period of Pax Britannica was the period of relative peace in Europe between 1815 and 1914, when the British Empire controlled most of the key maritime trade routes and enjoyed unchallenged sea power. It refers to a period of British imperialism after the 1815 Battle of Waterloo, which led to a period of overseas British expansion. So, you history buffs will remember some of these benchmarks. So, quite an illustrious history of what is now fast becoming a shrinking nation. And I have some rather unsettling quotations here from an article entitled, "Godlessness Has Doomed Britain." This is written by a rabbi, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. This article appeared in a recent issue of the Jerusalem Post. Listen to this rabbi's assessment of Britain today. Britain today has become one of the most godless societies on earth. Its principal religious exports today are thinkers who despise religion, quite unlike the British exports of the heyday of the British Empire. Quite the opposite was the case. The Church of England had quite a dominant perspective on things, and of course there were other religious connections with the British Empire and the British Commonwealth that were clear and unmistakable. But today, I think most would agree that essentially the rabbi is right. Britain has quickly becoming one of the most godless societies on earth. Continuing, from Richard Dawkins, who has compared religion to child abuse, to my friend Christopher Hitchens, who has titled his 2007 book, "God Is Not Great, How Religion Spoils Everything." Those are two British authors whose works have been exported. The titles don't sound too intriguing to me. How about you? Although I must admit to having one of them on my bookshelf simply for a reference. The British have cornered the market on being anti-God, at least the Christian and Jewish varieties of God. While 92% of Americans believe in God, according to one survey, 92%, and we'll have more to say about America or Manasseh here in just a few moments, in Britain, only 35% claim to to believe in God. And, according to Britain's National Center for Social Research, 43% of Brits say they have no religion. My British friends, he continues, argue that the demise of religion is a good thing, proving sophistication in sharp contrast to the religious hobos of America who speak in tongues and talk to dead people. So the general feeling in Britain is that Christianity American style is somewhat of a laughing stock and an outrageous aberration, and really, good riddance, we don't need anything like that. That's the British impression. Continuing. British influence in the world, in contrast, has gone off a cliff over the past century. I would argue that the new militant atheism that is becoming characteristic of Britain is a key reason. Militaristic atheism. Or militant atheism, I should say, an intense desire to promote the atheistic attitude and approach. Quite a shocking development. Now, what about Ephraim's brother? As you know, Joseph had two sons in Egypt, and when it came time for Jacob to bless Joseph's sons, Jacob adopted the two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and the great blessings that were passed down from Abraham, Isaac, and on through Jacob were then placed upon Ephraim and Manasseh, Joseph's two sons. Let's see what we can find out about Manasseh this afternoon, Britain's former colonial outlying colonies, I should say. Remember how many colonies we were under British rule? 13 colonies. How many sons did Jacob prophesy about in the latter part of Genesis? 13 sons. 13 sons. Joseph was the 12th. The adoption of Ephraim and Manasseh split Joseph into two, resulting in 13. A coincidence, perhaps, but an interesting item to note. Well, where do we begin to describe our national situation? How about our national debt? It now stands over $14 trillion. $14 trillion. Our current president and Congress are locked in a battle over raising the nation's debt limit in an effort to avoid national default and the shutdown of the federal government, similar to what happened in Minnesota here a couple of weeks ago. That crisis seems to have passed, and now Minnesotans can buy fishing licenses and cigarettes and alcohol, the three things that most Minnesotans missed during the government shutdown. Another article from the Wall Street Journal, most Minnesotans didn't notice anything about the government being shut down other than they couldn't buy a fishing license, alcohol was running out, and cigarettes were difficult to find. Other than that, they didn't miss government. Odd. And one wonders how much we would miss the federal government if it shut down. However, there is an August deadline looming, and if that deadline passes without a budget deal and without the debt ceiling being raised or the budget being brought under control, Standard & Poor's, along with Moody's, are both threatening to downgrade America's massive debt. And what will that mean? Well, it would cost you and me, the taxpayers of this nation, billions of extra dollars in debt service costs. And it would jeopardize our credit on the world market, and all those bonds that people are buying would suddenly not be purchased, and we would be in very deep water. Now, is that saber-rattling? Will it really happen? Will the President and Congress come to agreement? Well, the likelihood is that the President is going to be given permission to raise the debt ceiling, And it's also quite likely that he's going to go into the next election being the sole person responsible for the raising of that debt and the likely raising of taxes, which will not be a pleasant thing for him to consider. And so a lot of angles are being played in Washington these days. Will taxes be raised or lowered? Will spending be cut or increased? And they've been wrangling over that for weeks. What will the outcome be? I have no idea. Stay tuned. Of course, many fear that our current president is leading our nation toward the European model of tax and spend fiscal policy, and I think all of us are quite well aware of where that has gotten Europe and how difficult circumstances are in Europe right now as far as their fiscal stability, and even the survival of the euro is at stake in some people's estimation. And, of course, several nations are on the verge of bankruptcy as well, and everybody's trying to calm everybody else down, but it doesn't seem to be working. Several banks were examined in Europe, by the way, last week. 8 out of 10 passed. Did the world cheer? No, they wondered how stringent the restrictions were regarding the examination of the banks. They thought, well, maybe they got a pass based on a light inspection without too much concern over these specifics. All is not well on the global economic scene. Well, now let's zero in on Manasseh's character. What about our national character? I've got several quotes here that I'd like to read to illustrate the character of our nation, if you can call it that. Listen to what is happening in a land where 92% of its citizens claim to believe in God. Listen. Consider New York Representative Anthony Weiner, an elected official, sending lewd pictures of himself via his cell phone, denying it, then admitting it, then attempting to redeem himself, all in a very public and disgraceful setting. One of our political leaders. The lack of judgment and morals among politicians, athletes, and business leaders is appalling. From our own Arnold Schwarzenegger to Bill Clinton, from Kobe Bryant to Tiger Woods, the moral fabric of our nation isn't just fraying. It seems to be disintegrating. Just down the road in San Francisco, the 100th annual Bay to Breakers Crosstown Foot Race was held on May 15th. Hopefully none of you participated. Nudity on the part of participants was no problem, according to city officials. That was perfectly acceptable. However, they were concerned about other forms of debauchery, such as controlling the flow of alcohol at the event, since many of the participants in the race, quote-unquote, had little interest in running. Their primary focus was finding creative ways to transport alcohol for 7.5 miles. That's what the city was concerned about. And this Bay to Breakers race has been running for 100 years. This from The Economist, July 2nd, 2011, Dateline, New York. The Stonewall Inn in New York's West Village is famous in gay history as the scene of riots against the police in 1969. On June 29th of this year, Roy O'Neill and Michael Giggle stood just across the street from it to watch the city's Pride March. The couple's daughter, Kira, sat on Mr. Giggle's shoulders for a better view. This year's march was even more joyous than usual. Some 16 hours earlier, New York had become the 6th and most populous state to legalize same-sex marriages. After watching the vote on their sofa, Mr. O'Neill and Mr. Giggle, proposed to each other. So they had a daughter. They weren't yet married, but now with the passage of the bill in New York legalizing same-sex marriages, they proposed to one another, and so presumably they will become a family because now they are married. New York becomes the sixth and most populous state to legalize same-sex marriages. Here's another. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court, based upon First Amendment free speech, struck down a California law. Now, it's a little hard to believe that California would even try to pass this law, but they did. Congratulations, California. Struck down a California law forbidding the sale to minors of violent video games, generally called shooter games. Shooter games. These games give players the option of killing, maiming, dismembering, or sexually assaulting an image of a human being. So apparently you have a menu of choices. California tried to outlaw the sale of these games to minors. The Supreme Court struck it down. Freedom of speech. In his concurring opinion, Justice Samuel Alito cited a recent news story about a planned video game called School Shooter North American Tour 2012, which lets players reenact the Columbine or Virginia Tech massacres. So apparently you have a menu there, too. You can choose which one of those tragedies and disasters you would like to recreate in video. Apparently, as long as the victims are fictional, no amount of slaughter is off limits. What kind of society, what kind of culture, what kind of nation allows things like this to occur in the name of free speech? Because you can do something doesn't mean you should do it. And of course, in one sense, when you look at the Supreme Court and the precedents and the benchmarks that have been set for First Amendment free speech, it is not surprising that they ruled as they did. And I would not, if I were you, and I am not because I'm me, rushing to judgment on the Supreme Court. Who will I rush to judgment to before I rush to judgment on the Supreme Court? I would rush to judgment on parents who would allow this. I would rush to judgment on corporations and companies that would create this. This is an outrageous and disgusting act that should be absolutely protested and eliminated from the scene completely. What is it even doing in the Supreme Court? How did it ever get there? We have such a tolerant, passive society. Anything goes. And indeed, we're going to see prophetically that exactly these kinds of things were prophesied to come to pass. So both Britain and the United States, both Ephraim and Manasseh, appear to be in full-blown moral, spiritual, intellectual, and economic decline. This afternoon, I'd like to examine some scriptures, some prophecies that foretold and described this unfolding disaster. Let's begin in Genesis chapter 35. Genesis chapter 35. Is there no sense of shame in our nation? Is there no sense of outrage? It's a very disturbing thing. I think for those of us who grew up in the 1940s and the 1950s, we must almost feel like refugees in our own country, as foreigners, as people who have landed on another planet. This is certainly not the America that I grew up in the 50s and the 60s. When, even if my parents didn't know where I was, most of my school teachers and most of the other adults who knew me knew where I was, what I was doing, and wouldn't hesitate to tell my parents about it. So how do you think that impacted on my behavior? Well, I knew no matter where I went in town, I'd have a parent there. I'd have an adult who cared about me and who would not hesitate to correct me. And I never played a video game. I was too busy out riding my bike and doing all kinds of things that boys did back then, fish and climb trees and chuck rocks in the lake and ride your bike and play baseball, football, basketball, run track, you name it. But now it seems life is different, quite different. And it's very hard to believe that we're living in the same nation. When you see some of these things that are going on, you might think, well, that's out there somewhere. Well, it's down the road in San Francisco. It's right here in Sacramento with a good governor. What an example. And I guess he's still going forward with his Hero children's book series. He's going to write children's books with, I guess, good moral stories with a happy ending. I don't know what he's going to call them. I'll have to look that up on the... I'll have to Google that on the internet and see if that's still a part of his future. I'm not buying the books. Character. What happened to it? Instead of building character, it seems many of our leaders have become characters. Unsavory. Unwholesome. Unchristian. Very sad commentary. Genesis chapter 35, verse 11. God speaks to Jacob. He says, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings shall come from your body. And when you look at this verse and read a nation and a company of nations, can you give me another possibility in all of history that so closely parallels and aligns itself with this verse as the United States and Britain? There isn't one. A great nation and a great company of nations. And when you add to that the other sons of Jacob, who basically had descendants settling in many of the Western European countries, you find that the rich blessings of Western Europe, of Britain and the United States, were clearly a part of the blessings passed on through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then on to the sons of Israel. 13. It's a remarkable story. We've all read the United States and Britain in prophecy. Just a brief review today of some of the highlights. Genesis chapter 48. Genesis 48. Verse 17. Now when Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. Why? Well, because Ephraim was the second born. He took a hold of his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head and put it on Manasseh's head. However, in verse 19, his father refused. Jacob said, I know, my son. I know Joseph. I know it. He also shall be a people, or become a people. Manasseh will also become a people, and he shall also be great. But truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. A multitude of nations. Quite a remarkable prophecy. And through generations, through hundreds of years, we find it coming to pass. It's a remarkable story, a remarkable account. Verse 20. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and as Manasseh. And thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh, the British Commonwealth, and the descendants of Ephraim before Manasseh, and, of course, the United States of America. And notice, it would be the standard by which Israel would bless their countrymen. If they wanted to really ask God's blessing on you as an individual in ancient Israel, they would say, may God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. There couldn't be a bigger blessing than that. And when you look around at the fabulous blessings that we have enjoyed nationally, both here and in Britain, and when you consider the Commonwealth of Nations, what other answer, what other solution is there than the one that has been posed by the church for years? Let's now turn to the prophet Hosea, chapter 4. Hosea, chapter 4. Verse 1. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel. Now, it seems that there are a couple of different ways to read the Old Testament prophets. You can read the Old Testament prophets as harbingers of the destruction and fall of Israel, the destruction and fall and eventual captivity of Judah. Or you can read these scriptures and verses prophetically in that they refer to the modern-day descendants of Israel. And it seems that very few understand these prophecies in that context because, as you know, as we have been taught and as we have taught for many years, the identity of the United States and Britain in prophecy changes everything and gives you an entirely different perspective on many of these prophets' writings and the predictions that they make. And I want you to read these verses in Hosea in the context of Hosea's warning, not against ancient Israel, but against modern Israel, the modern descendants. Hear the word of the Lord, you children of Israel, for the Lord brings a charge against the inhabitants of the land. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. Remember the rabbi's comments about a godless Britain. It wasn't always so, but it is now. There is no truth or mercy or knowledge of God in the land. By swearing and lying, killing and stealing and committing adultery, they break all restraint. Consider some of the stories and quotations that I just read. They break all restraint. Killing, stealing, committing adultery, with bloodshed upon bloodshed, whether it be video games or in real life. Therefore, the land will mourn, and everyone who dwells there will waste away, with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, even the fish of the sea will be taken away. Quite dramatic descriptions of destruction. Verse 6. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will reject you from being priest for me. Because you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children. The more they increase, the more they sinned against me, I will change their glory into shame. The once glorious and magnificent British Empire is no longer glorious and magnificent. And the shameful nature of the society and culture of godless Britain is testimony to the fulfillment of these prophecies. In chapter 7 of Hosea, verse 8, Ephraim has mixed himself among the peoples. Ephraim is a cake unturned, burning on one side and half cooked on the other. Not done. Ephraim is a cake unturned. Aliens have devoured his strength. And again, watch carefully as the British nation begins to feel the impact of many different ethnic groups that have move to Britain, and of course the same is across the entire European continent, the Muslim faith, the teachings of Islam, the influence of many different cultures will eventually erode what we have commonly come to know as British culture and European culture, and there will be clashes and extreme social unrest and difficulty as a result. That has already been the case to some extent, and when you add the financial woes that the nations of Europe are going to experience, it's going to create a very volatile environment. Somewhat similar to what we have seen unfold in the Middle East, and we now see that Libya has been recognized, the rebel government there. Millions of dollars are going to be unfrozen and given to the rebels. It looks as though Mr. Gaddafi is on a short leash right now. I don't give him much of a chance. And it looks as though Syria is being backed into a corner as well. So we have a number of developments in the Middle East and across Europe that are adding to the fulfillment of prophecy. And this description of Ephraim is extremely accurate. Notice this. Verse 9, aliens have devoured his strength. Speaking of Ephraim or Britain. But he does not know it. He doesn't know it. Yes, gray hairs are here and there on him, yet he does not know it. He's not aware that he's aging. He's not aware that he's not the great Commonwealth of Nations, the great powerhouse that he once was. And the pride of Israel testifies to his face, but they do not return to the Lord their God nor seek him for all of this. So despite their downhill slide, they do not turn to God. They do not recognize him. They continue to walk the other way and become, as the rabbi said, a nation of atheists. Shocking. Turn with me to Isaiah chapter 1. The prophet Isaiah chapter 1. Now, most commentaries will identify the book of Isaiah as a book of judgment and prophetic warning geared primarily to the nation of Judah. For it covers the reign of four kings of Judah. However, I want you to note here in the first chapter that the prophet speaks to Israel, which includes all of the tribes, all of the sons, which includes Ephraim and Manasseh. And as we read this prophetic description, see if it doesn't describe the modern-day descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh, modern-day descendants of Israel. Verse 2, Isaiah chapter 1. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth, for the Lord has spoken. I have nourished and brought up children, and they have rebelled against me. Many of us as parents can understand that. And if we've never experienced it, surely we can appreciate how it would feel to carefully and lovingly bring up a child and have them rebel against you, turn against you, attack you, desert you, malign you, discredit you. How would that feel? It wouldn't feel very good, would it? God feels the same way about a nation he brought up and raised and blessed and nurtured and cared for. And that nation turned their back. And God feels in a similar fashion to a parent seeing their rebellious children turn against them. He likens Israel to members of the animal kingdom. Verse 3, the ox knows his owner. Your dog knows who you are. You ever notice that? Your dog knows exactly who the alpha male in the house is. Your dog recognizes you by your smell. Now, none of us think we smell or have an odor, let's put it that way. But your dog's nose is about 900 times more sensitive than yours, So even if you think you don't have a unique fragrance, let's put it that way, your dog knows you do. It's an amazing thing. A dog, an ox, any other pet, any animal that's been domesticated and has been around its owner knows its owner, recognizes its owner. Where does my dog go when she wants dinner? Next door? Across the street? Is she showing up at your house about 5:30? No. She comes to one of us and makes noise or drags her bowl or sits and stares at us right by the bowl. There's some signal that I'm hungry yet busy. She knows. But notice verse 3. The ox knows its owner, the donkey its master's crib, but Israel does not know. Israel plays ignorant. Israel claims it doesn't know its maker. It doesn't know its spiritual creator. Israel doesn't know its father. It's completely oblivious to its heritage and the laws and commandments and the nurturing and the blessing that God gave Israel, generation after generation after generation, the way he kept coming back and nurturing them and relieving them and bringing them back out of captivity, giving them their land again and again and again until finally they went into captivity for good and became the lost tribes. But he will gather them again. His love will not fail. The point God is trying to make here, Israel does not know, my people do not consider. They have thoroughly and completely turned their back on their Maker, on their Creator, on their Sustainer, on the great God. And when you read the chilling statements that I've read this afternoon, and we could go on, couldn't we? The internet is full of them. Publications are out there everywhere describing the decline of Western culture and civilization, specifically the decline of Britain and the United States. It's not a secret. It's quite shocking. Verse 4, alas, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity. Not just a small backpack, but a huge dump truck, laden with iniquity, with lawlessness, a brood of evildoers. Children who are corruptors. Not just adults, but children who are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord. They have provoked to anger the Holy One of Israel. They have turned away backward. Certainly, nationally, we have turned away backward. Why should you be stricken again? You will revolt more and more. So even if I strike you and chastise you, you'll just rebel more and more. You won't heed. You won't course correct. You'll just rebel even more. You will revolt more and more, it says. Verse 5, the whole head is sick. The whole heart faints. From the sole of the foot even to the head, there is no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. A disgusting description of a human body fraught with sickness and illness used to describe national Israel, Ephraim and Manasseh, if you will. They have been closed or bound up. They have not been closed or bound up or soothed with ointment, these open sores. Your country is desolate. Your cities are burned with fire. Strangers devour your land and your presence. And it is desolate as overthrown by strangers. And of course, as we see our economy deteriorate, as we see ownership of land and property and corporations in the United States become increasingly international in scope, as we come to the point where we manufacture very little in this country and import almost everything, perhaps we've lost sight of the possibility that many of these scriptures that describe another country occupying us could just as easily be describing economic oppression, as well as military oppression. Because in this world in which you and I live, economic and financial dominance can lead to oppression in the have-not countries, and one wonders how long it will take us to arrive there. Now, verse 9. Unless the Lord of hosts had left to us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have been made like Gomorrah. So a very small remnant remained faithful. And if that remnant had not been there, Israel would have become like Sodom and would have been made like Gomorrah. And what does that mean? Gone. Burnt. Burnt up. Disintegrated. Non-existent. That's Sodom and Gomorrah. They are no more. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear to the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah. And what were some of the primary characteristics of the degenerate society and culture of Sodom and Gomorrah? The same kind of sexual sins that we referred to earlier this afternoon. And yet, it has become so commonplace as to be codified into law. And what a statement regarding the downward slide of morals and ethics in the nations of Israel, their modern descendants, Ephraim and Manasseh, Britain and the United States. Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom, and give ear to the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices to me? Yes, over, what was it, 90% of Americans? Let's see, let's get that percentage right here, because that is an important figure. 92% of Americans believe in God? Do they believe in this God? To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I've had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed cattle. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or lambs or goats. And, of course, this is obviously referring to animal sacrifices given and offered up, apparently by ancient Israel to God, half-heartedly or without sincerity. And if you'd like to bring it into the 21st century and the modern counterpart, look at the Christian churches that dot the landscape here in 92% God-believing, God-fearing, quote-unquote, America. Christianity is everywhere. Check out television. Check out the Internet. All of this supposed worship of God, and at the same time, all of these unsavory, unseemly things going on, the hypocrisy shouts and screams. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices to me? Why do you do this? Verse 12, when you come to appear before me, who has required this from your hand? To trample my courts. Bring no more futile sacrifices. Incense is an abomination to me. The new moons, the Sabbaths, and the calling of assemblies. In other words, your religious practices, the ones you have endorsed. I can't endure iniquity and the sacred meeting. They have no significance to me. Your attitude pollutes everything you do. Your new moons, your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They are a trouble to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you may make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Quite a condemnation to modern-day Sodom and Gomorrah. You rulers of Sodom, you people of Gomorrah. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, put away evil. The evil, rather, of your doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Seek justice. Rebuke the oppressor. Defend the fatherless. Plead for the widow. Come now, and let us reason together, says the Eternal. Though your sins are like scarlet, they shall be white as snow. Though they are red like crimson, they shall be as wool. If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. And which path does it appear that America and Britain have chosen? A path of refusal and rebellion. And just as surely as Sodom and Gomorrah met their demise, so God will send what he prophesies here, the sword. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Notice in Micah chapter 5. Micah 5. Jonah, Micah. Verse 7. Micah 5, verse 7. Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples. Now listen to this description of the descendants of Jacob and how they have had an impact on the world. It sounds so much like the British Commonwealth of Nations. Listen to this description. Then the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on the grass, that tarry for no man, nor wait for the sons of men. And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of sheep, who, if he passes through, both treads down and tears in pieces, and none can deliver. Your hand shall be lifted up against your adversaries, and all your enemies shall be cut off. And how else could Britain have succeeded in dominating the world as they did for all those years? Obviously, divine intervention played a part. And it shall be in that day, says the Lord, that I will cut off your horses from your midst and destroy your chariots. It would come to an end. Your armaments, your ships, your weaponry would be destroyed. I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all of your strongholds. I will cut off sorceries from your hand, and you shall have no soothsayers. And oddly enough, the final installment of Harry Potter recently opened. The harmless story of witchcraft and sorcery. And God says, I will cut off all sorceries from your hand, and you shall have no soothsayers. Again, it's so easy to call evil good and good evil in our twisted and distorted world. Your carved images I will also cut off, your sacred pillars from your midst. You shall no more worship the work of your hands. I will pluck your wooden images from your midst. Thus I will destroy your cities, and I will execute vengeance in anger and fury on the nations that have not heard. And so the consequences of the rebellion of Jacob's sons are clear and real. In Jeremiah chapter 30, Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 5. For thus says the Lord, we have heard a voice of trembling, of fear, and not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with a child. Why do I see every man with his hands on his loins, like a woman in labor, and all faces turn pale? You've never seen anything like this, the prophet said. Alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it, and it is the time of Jacob's trouble. The time of Jacob's trouble. The trouble focused on the descendants of Jacob, and two of those key descendants, Ephraim and Manasseh. But he shall be saved out of it. And that's a comforting thing to know, that Christ will intervene and prevent total destruction of the human race. Let's conclude by turning to 2 Peter chapter 2. We've reviewed some of the prophecies and predictions for Ephraim and Manasseh. We've taken a look at the current state of affairs in both nations. We've examined some of the historical context, particularly of Britain's rise to power. Turn now with me to 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter 2, verse 4. This is how certain the consequences of sin really are. And when you read this with an understanding and reflect on what we have read today, how certain and how sure is God's intervention in the situation that we are confronting as a nation, that Britain is confronting? For if God, verse 4, 2 Peter 2, did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. God did that to the rebellious angels, and their judgment is forthcoming. He did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. He did that. It took 120 years to build the ark. I'm sure Noah wondered if he would do it, but he did do it. And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes. You rulers of Sodom, Isaiah said. You people of Gomorrah. Here's what happened to ancient Sodom and Gomorrah. The same will come close to happening to modern Sodom and Gomorrah. Ancient Sodom and Gomorrah were turned into ashes, condemned to destruction, made an example to those who afterward would live ungodly. Apparently, it hasn't had the desired impact in Ephraim and Manasseh. And delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. And we are living in the midst of Sodom and Gomorrah and should take note of what happened to Lot and his family, how he was tormented day and night, and his perspective was twisted, and God brought him out, he and his family. However, his wife turned back. She couldn't bear to leave. That's how deeply impacted she was by the environment in which she lived. And we need to fight to come out of her and be separate, as the book of Revelation commands us. Very difficult challenge for all of us in this day of time. But listen to these comforting words. The Lord knows how, verse 9, to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. God knows how to deliver us. And as we pursue His ways, His laws, and His commandments, we can claim that promise of deliverance. I have one final scripture, the prophet Micah, chapter 4. Micah, chapter 4. Verse 14. Excuse me, Micah 7. I'll get it right yet. Micah 7. Micah 7, verse 14. Shepherd your people with your staff. Capital S, capital Y, capital Y. Speaking of God, God, please shepherd your people with your staff, the flock of your heritage, who dwell solitarily in a woodland. In the midst of Carmel, let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old. This too is a prophecy, but it speaks of the time of the millennium, the time of peace for Israel and restoration. Let them feed in Bashan and Gilead as in the days of old, As in the days when you came up out of the land of Egypt, I will show them wonders. The nations shall see and be ashamed of all of their might. They shall put their hand over their mouth. Their ears shall be deaf. They shall lick the dust like a serpent. They shall crawl from their holes like snakes of the earth. They shall be afraid of the Lord our God, for they have just seen the wrath of God unfold before their very eyes in the form of the seven last plagues and the dramatic return of Jesus Christ at the sounding of the seventh trump. They are hiding, they are shocked, they are appalled, and now they see the glory of God and the glory of Israel restored. They are ashamed, they put their hands over their mouths. Their ears are as they were deaf. They crawl from their holes. They are afraid of God. They are still fearful. Continuing, verse 18. Who is a God like you, pardoning iniquity, passing over the transgression of the remnant of his heritage? He's still going to offer them mercy and kindness and forgiveness. He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in mercy. He will again have compassion on us, that is, on Israel, and will subdue our iniquities. You will cast all of our sins into the depths of the sea. You will give truth to Jacob and mercy to Abraham, which you have sworn to our fathers from days of old. So you see, even the prophets recognize the continuance of the blessings through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The mercy extended to Abraham, sworn to our fathers, through Jacob, to the 12 sons, to the nations that enjoyed those blessings, the nations that turned their backs on God, the same nations that will be saved and restored by Christ's return. What a joyous message, and what a wonderful opportunity to understand these truths and to look forward to a time when Jacob's trouble will be no more, and the blessings of God will be there for all to enjoy.